Yes, exactly. So, like, what is it called when, like, you know, they, like, comedy club, they go and get, just go and round up random people to bring you in to make the room a little bit.
Open mic. No, sorry.
Just to make the audience a little, you know, the more packed it is, the better the jokes go down, you know. It's like that. Let me get started.
Today and tomorrow, probably I'll be able to finish tomorrow. So we're gonna be sort of covering the three main schemes of grand unification. Okay, and so each of these kind of reveals a different pattern underlying the standard model, and we want to see, you know, the first two of those, SU5 and Patti Salam grand unification, each reveal some underlying structure in the standard model, and then SO10 or spin 10 is the most unified scheme of all. It really includes both of these guys and ends up collapsing this table down to just a single component, really. It's the table for SO10 is a table like this, but there's only one entry instead of 3 × 6 entries. I didn't take the time during the lecture to write it. So here we have our table, right? And we were just saying that that we could switch to this new notation where we write each of the Hilbert spaces, each of the vector spaces in which each of the irreducible representations live in this new tensor product notation. And just to make sure that we're on the same page, I just wanted to take 1 minute to make sure we're clear about direct sum versus direct product, direct sum versus tensor product notation like this. So just to remind you, so if V is a vector space with basis vectors V1 through Vm, okay, it's an arbitrary complex linear combination of those m vectors, so that's some m-dimensional vector space. And W is a vector space with basis vectors W1 through Wn, so it's an n-dimensional vector space. So V direct sum W is a new vector space that's constructed by just taking the union of these basis vectors. So it has basis vectors V1 through Vm, and W1 through Wn. Okay, it's an arbitrary complex linear combination of all those guys, so this is an n plus m dimensional vector space. Whereas, as we mentioned last time, V tensor W is a linear combination of all basis vectors of the form, of all basis vectors formed by taking a pair of these guys and these guys. So all basis vectors of the form Vi tensor WJ. Okay, so there will be m times n of those. So this will be an m times n dimensional vector space. Okay, and what we had said last time was that, so for a single generation of particles, each individual particle, we're used to thinking of a tensor with one index, like V alpha in GR as being a vector, for example, a vector in the tangent space of the manifold. But then a tensor with multiple indices, well, that's also a vector. It just lives in a vector space that's a tensor product of some smaller vector spaces. So this is like that. You know, Q carries a bunch of indices. It's a tensor with a bunch of indices. And so it lives in this vector space, which is a tensor product, et cetera. And then the space of all the particles in the standard model is the direct sum of all of these guys, and the space that the antiparticles live in is the direct sum of all of these guys. But then we said there's another, for understanding grand unification, there's another breakup that'll be convenient, which is to define instead the space F, which is the direct sum of all the left-handed guys, so Q left plus direct sum with U right star, direct sum with D right star, direct sum with L left, direct sum with nu right star, and with E right star, and then F star is the corresponding right-handed fields. Okay. And so the total vector space of particles and antiparticles in a single generation of the standard model is just F direct sum F star. And the whole idea, one of the main ideas in granularification is to find some bigger gauge theory that contains the standard model with some very simple representation that when you break its symmetry down to the standard model gauge group, that simple representation decomposes into exactly this more complicated representation, F plus F star. Okay. And the basic idea is simple. So, we spent the first half of the course discussing how a theory whose fundamental symmetry group is SU3 times SU2 times U1 hypercharge has its symmetry spontaneously broken so that at low energies, the low energies where we normally do our experiments, symmetry that we see in our low energy theory, symmetry that remains unbroken, is just SU3 times U1 electromagnetism, U1Q, because the Higgs broke this bigger group down to this subgroup. So just like the symmetry we observe at low energies is a subgroup of this bigger symmetry, which we would see if we did physics above the electroweak energy scale, the idea of grand unification is, well, maybe this symmetry is also just the low energy broken version of some even, this is also maybe just the subgroup of some even bigger group at high energies, the grand unified group. And in a brief burst in the mid-70s, after the discovery of after the standard model fell into place, people found the three best examples of this group. Okay, so that's what we want to discuss. So there are two bigger groups we can embed G into. One is SU5, which we'll spend most of this lecture discussing. So that leads to SU5 grand unification, and that reveals one type of hidden structure in the standard model. But there's another embedding, which also is good, which is SU4 times SU2 times SU2, which reveals a different pattern in the standard model. This was actually the one that was discovered first by Patty and Salam. This is called Patty-Salam unification. And this one could be called George I. Glashow. They discovered that one right afterwards. And then both of these guys turn out to be subgroups of this bigger group, SO10, or really more correctly, SIN10, the double cover of SO10. And this, in some sense, gives the best grand unified theory of all. It incorporates both of these patterns. You find that when you incorporate both of these patterns at the same time, poof, not only does the group reduce to a single component like this, but also the representation of the fermions also reduces to a single reducible representation of this, the spinner of the Dirac spinner of that group. But okay, we'll get there. We're going to start in this lecture with SU5. Okay. So fine. How does it go? So we want to regard the standard model gauge group, SU3 times SU2 times U1, we want to regard that as a subgroup of the bigger group SU5. So somehow that means that we want to, remember every element of this group was a triplet of elements, U3, the unitary matrix, the 3x3 unitary U3, comma, the 2x2 unitary U2, comma, a complex phase alpha. And we wanna say that every time we have an element of this group, secretly, we have a subset of the elements of this group. So the elements of this group are 5 by 5 unitary matrices. And so somehow we wanna map a triplet of objects like this into a 5 by 5 unitary matrix. So, well, how can we do it? Well, let me first remind you, you know, how does the product here go? Remember that the way you take the product of two elements, U3, you know, what the product notation here means is that when we take the product of two elements, U3, U2 alpha, and U3 prime, U2 prime, alpha prime, that's just given by taking the product of each component separately. So U3, U3 prime, comma U2, U2 prime, comma alpha, alpha prime. But that means that, you know, each of these components commute with one another.
Don't alpha plus alpha prime?
No, if you took the phases, they would. So I'm thinking of alpha as the actual group element. So alpha is e to the alpha is like e to the I phi. So if you thought of it as phi, yeah, it depends a little bit on notation. Yeah, but anyway. So for in this, but actually that's an important point. You know, you can regard U1 as either the additive group of phases between 0 and 2 pi, or the additive group of e to the I phases, the multiplicative group of e to the I phases. And actually, for this lecture, it's important that we're going to be using this. So you know what you can see here is that if I took an element of SU3 and an element of SU2, they commute because, you know, an element of U3 in this notation would be of SU3 would be the element U3 1 1, and then if I multiplied that by an element of SU2, that would be 1 comma U2 comma 1. So when I take their product, you know, that just becomes U3 comma U2 comma 1, but then I can just rewrite that as this in the opposite notation. That's equally equal to 1 comma U2 comma 1 times U3 comma 1 comma 1. Okay, so I have to make sure that however I do this embedding into here, that these two guys commute. So that's a big hint about how to do it. Because if you think of U5, U5 is a matrix that acts on some five-dimensional vector space. And if I want, okay. If I want U3 and U2 to commute, they should act on different subspaces of that vector space. If they act on overlapping subspaces of that vector space, of the five-dimensional vector space, they won't commute with one another. So in other words, if I start by asking how should I embed the element U3 in SU5, well, let's say I work in a basis where I write this, where this U3 acts on, you know, it's going to act on some three-dimensional subspace of the five-dimensional. This is a five-dimensional vector space acting on some This is a 5 by 5 matrix acting on some five-dimensional vector space. Let me choose my basis for this five-dimensional vector space so that the three-dimensional subspace acted on U3 is in the bottom. Okay, so then that says that this should be embedded like in a block diagonal form where U3 is in the bottom component here, so it just mixes up these three components. And then we have the 2 by 2 identity matrix up here. Okay, I sub 2. Then it's clear if I what I have to do if I want U2, the embedding of U2 to commute with it. I should do the opposite. I should have it in the upper 2 by 2 block. And the identity matrix, the 3 by 3 identity matrix, in the lower 3 by 3 block. Okay, and so now, so far so good. I've embedded U3 and U2, but now I still need to figure out how to embed U1. So if I take an element of my group SU3 times SU2 times U1, where it's just a non-trivial complex phase alpha, how do I embed that guy in such a way that it commutes with both of these guys? Well, in order for this to commute The only thing that will commute with an arbitrary 2x2 unitary will be a 2x2 matrix that's proportional to the identity. So my embedding here has to be proportional to the identity in the upper 2x2 block, but then it also has to be proportional to the identity in the lower 2x2 block, because it also has to commute with U3. So it has to be some embedding of the form alpha to the p times the 2x2 identity up here in the upper block, and alpha to the q times the 3x3 identity in the lower block. So far so good. That will be a, so you know this U3 and U2 we were already assuming that they were determinant one unitary matrices. And so as a consequence, this 5x5 matrix is also a determinant one unitary matrix, and so is this one. What about this matrix? Well, it is unitary because it's diagonal with just complex phases along the diagonal, so that's unitary. But we also have to make sure it has determinant one for an arbitrary U1 phase alpha. And so in order for that to be the case, well, it's a diagonal matrix, we can just compute the determinant. It's alpha to the p times alpha to the p twice, and then times alpha to the q times alpha to the q times alpha to the q. So in order for that to be have determinant one, we have to have 2p, the two p's that we get from here, times 3q, I mean plus 3q, equal to zero. Right, that's the condition that this thing has determinant one for arbitrary alpha. And so any solution of this equation will work for p and q, but the simplest one, taking different solutions will just be equivalent. Remember here I had the freedom to rescale the charges by a constant factor, and that's all that taking different solutions here does. So what I want to take is the simplest solution here, the one that will reproduce this convention. So that turns out to be where I take p equal to 3, q equal to minus. Okay, so putting it all together, p equal to 3 and q equal to minus 2, I should say. Then that's the solution to this equation. So putting it all together, an arbitrary element of the standard model, we found that up to that choice of convention has a unique embedding in SU5, which looks like this. The upper 2x2 block is alpha to the 3 times U2, and the lower 3x3 block is alpha to the minus 2 times U3. Okay? So far so good? So now, before we go any further, let's notice one interesting thing about this, which is that, that there are certain choices that this mapping of SU3 times SU2 times U1 into SU5 is not one-to-one, because there's certain choices of elements here that get mapped to the identity, the 5x5 identity matrix here. So in particular, suppose I took the element, suppose for U3, I took the particular 3x3 unitary matrix alpha to the minus 3, suppose I took alpha to the plus 2 times the 3x3 identity matrix. And then for U2, suppose I took alpha to the minus 3 times the 2x2 identity matrix, and then alpha. Well, first of all, this is a unitary matrix, but it's only a determinant. This was supposed to be a determinant one unitary matrix. So in order for this matrix to also have determinant one, I can't do this for any alpha. Alpha has to satisfy this property that the determinant of this matrix, which is alpha squared times alpha squared times alpha squared, because it's 3x3, alpha to the 6, that has to be equal to 1. Okay, so if alpha to the 6 is equal to 1, this guy has determinant 1, Oh, but so does this guy, because now this guy has determinant alpha to the minus 3 times alpha to the minus 3, so that's alpha to the minus 6. So that's also 1. Okay, so now, as long as alpha is a sixth root of unity, this is a legitimate example of a group element. But now if we look at what it maps to here, well, if we put alpha squared times I3 here, alpha squared cancels this minus alpha squared. This cancels this alpha to the minus 2. And if we put alpha to the minus 3 times I2 here, the alpha to the minus 3 cancels this alpha to the 3. And so we would get this thing would just map to the 5 by 5 identity matrix. OK, so we've found 6 different elements in our full group that all map to the same trivial element in SU5. So that's saying, comes as a little bit of a surprise, but we can't embed the full, we find that we actually can't embed the full standard model gauge group SU3 times SU2 times U1 in SU5. Instead, what we've managed to embed is a slightly smaller group, this group mod Z6. Mod the six-element finite group, which all gets mapped to the identity there. Okay, six elements because this could be any sixth root of unity. And there's only six. Okay, but so that makes a prediction then that says if this scheme is right, if this SU5 scheme is right, then. Well, all along we thought that the standard model was representing this bigger group, but secretly the gauge group is actually this smaller group. And if that's true, well, that says that whenever we look at an element of the bigger group here, an element of this form, which we thought was a non-trivial element, when we look at the representation on the standard model gauge group, when we look at the representation on the standard model fields, actually the representation of this element would have to be trivial. Well, let's check if that's true. So for example, let's see how Q left transforms under an element of this type. Does it transform non-trivially? Because if it does, then this scheme is not going to work. Well, how does it transform? We know that it transforms as a triplet under SU3. So from the triplet here, from the SU3, it'll pick up a factor of alpha squared. It transforms as a doublet under SU2. So from this element, it'll pick up a factor of alpha to the minus 3. And then under U1, we're working in the normalization where it transforms with charge 1. So it'll pick up one factor of alpha. OK, but this is all just alpha to the 0. So actually, Q left doesn't transform at all. So far, so good. Let's check one more case. And then I'll leave the remaining cases to you. So what about U right? Well, again, it transforms as a triplet. So it'll pick up this factor of alpha squared again. It doesn't transform under SU2, so it won't pick up this factor. Instead, it'll just pick up a factor of alpha to the 0 from SU2, because it transforms trivially under SU2. And then now it transforms with U1 charge instead of this guy, which transformed with U1 charge 1, this guy transforms with U1 charge 4. Okay, so that's how it would transform under the standard model gauge group. But this all is just alpha to the 6, and we said that we're only looking at these special elements where alpha is a sixth root of unity. So again, this turns out to all just be equal to 1. And so again, this guy doesn't transform. Yeah, if you just check all of the fields in the standard model, all the fermions and the Higgs twiddle, you'll find that they all transform trivially under this. They do indeed transform trivially under this kernel of the standard model gauge group under this map, under this Z6 kernel. So that's a hint that we're on the right path. And it also, if you think about it, is in a sense giving a new perspective on why the charges are quantized in the standard model. So in the standard model, you don't just have arbitrary charges here. They're all appearing as, in our original normalization, they're all appearing as multiple integer multiples of 1/6. That 1/6 is related to this alpha to the 6 being 1. It was crucial for all of these. You'll see that, you know, in this language, that has to be the case in order for all of the fields in the standard model to transform trivially when we do the second.
But does this just hint at the Z6 symmetry, or is this definitely the case?
Can you derive the so you mean does the standard model have to have this symmetry? No. So actually, if the standard model is embedded in SU5 or in any of these grand unified theories, then it does have to have this symmetry. But if it's not, then strictly speaking, it doesn't. And there could be a bigger, the gauge group could be bigger. It might be bigger than this, but you know, we would have no way to know it just from the fields available to us. Because as far as we can see from the table available to us, all of our fields do transform trivially under, you know, but it could be that there's some other field out there that we haven't discovered yet that would transform non-trivially under the gauge group. And then there would be some reality to the full gauge group without the mod Z6. But given the fields that we know at the moment, there's no evidence. It's all compatible with being mod Z6. So now I want to show the thing which I said at the beginning, which is that, or the thing which I mentioned at the end of the lecture last time, which is that if we construct this vector space, the exterior algebra lambda C5, the vector space of all the differential forms in 5 dimensions, that is a 32-dimensional vector space, which has a natural transformation under SU5. When we restrict SU5 to this standard model embedding, which was the unique embedding of the standard model that we could write down, gauge group, then this 32-dimensional vector space will end up transforming exactly like the 32-dimensional vector space of a single generation of standard model fermions. Okay, so in order to explain that, let me start by explaining what this vector space is a little bit more properly. So Cn, I remind you, this is just a notation for the n-dimensional complex vector space. So an arbitrary linear combination of the n basis elements e1 through en. Okay. Now, we reviewed a moment ago at the beginning of the lecture what Cn, tensor Cn means. It's the vector space of arbitrary, where the basis elements all have the form ei tensor ej for an arbitrary combination of the eis. So, and we take an arbitrary complex linear combination of these. So this was an n-dimensional vector space. This now is an n-squared dimensional vector space. So the space of two forms in n dimensions is the subspace of this space. So this n-squared dimensional vector space has a subspace whose basis elements are not arbitrary tensor products, but arbitrary anti-symmetrized tensor products. Okay, so lambda 2 of Cn, which is the vector space of two forms in n dimensions, is the subspace of that space where the basis elements are anti-symmetrized. So ei tensor ej minus ej tensor ei. Okay, so over here we had n times n different possibilities, but over here, if we take I and j to be the same thing, then these two guys will cancel, and that won't give us a non-trivial component of the vector space. We have to choose I different from j, and then once we've chosen the combination, you know, let's say I equals 1 and j equals 2, then choosing the combination 2 and 1 won't give us a different basis element. It'll just give us the opposite of the previous basis element. Okay, so the number of options available to us here is n choose 2. The dimension of this vector space is smaller than n squared. It's just n choose 2. In other words, n factorial over 2 factorial times n minus 2 factorial dimensional. Okay, and then p forms are just the p dimensional generalization of that. So if instead we took a tensor product of p copies of cn, so this is the, now the basis elements have this form where we take a product of p of these basis vectors, take an arbitrary complex linear combination of those. So now the dimension of this, we take p copies of this. So the dimension now is n to the p. Now the p forms in n dimensions are a subspace of this vector space, denoted lambda p of cn. And so again, as before, these are just the subset of basis elements of the form EI tensor dot 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 tensor EJ, where then at the end we anti-symmetrize over all of the indices. Take the totally anti-symmetric combination of any combination of basis vectors we want. And again, once we anti-symmetrize, we'll only get a non-zero answer if we choose all of the indices I dot 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 j to be different from one another. And so now in this case, the dimension of the vector space will be n choose p. So in other words, n factorial over p factorial times n minus p factorial dimensional. Okay, so that's the definition of what I mean by p forms in n dimensions. And then the exterior algebra lambda in n dimensions let me first tell you what the vector space is. This is just the exterior algebra is where you take all the forms and you can now take, it forms an algebra because you can take the product of an M form and an N form, you can take their wedge product and take and get an N plus M form. If you've played around at all with, I don't know which of you have or have not had much experience with working with differential forms, but anyway, you know, the point is that the differential forms, once you include the wedge, they live in this bigger vector space, which is just the direct sum of all the different levels. So we have the zero forms in n dimensions, direct sum with the one forms in n dimensions, direct sum with dot 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 up to the n forms in n dimensions. Okay, notice that you can't have higher than an n form in n dimensions because if you try to, you know, the n forms, well, this is the space of whose basis elements are a product of n EIs, which are all different from one another. Well, for n, you can do that because you have n EIs to work with. But if you try to make an n plus one form, you're out of luck because you only have n EIs to build it out of, and so two of the basis elements will by necessity be the same, and so when you anti-symmetrize, it'll vanish. That's why you can't have higher than an n form in n dimensions. Okay, so this is the what I mean by the vector space we're talking about. And again, it's called the exterior algebra because there's this, the vector space with a product defined on it. You can take the product of an M form and an N form to get an M plus N form by taking their wedge product. But we won't need that for this present discussion, so let's not get into it. Okay, so this guy, you know, if you work it out, always has 2 to the N dimensions. Okay, so The one more thing I need to explain before we can work out this fact is how so each piece of this vector space transforms as an irreducible representation of SUN, and there is a duality where the way this representation is isomorphic to the star of this representation, and this representation is isomorphic to the star of this representation. And in general, the pth, the representation coming from the pth component is isomorphic to the star, is equivalent to the representation, the star of the representation coming from the n minus pth component. Okay, so we want to see that the representation coming from the p forms in n dimensions is isomorphic to the representation to the star of the n minus p forms in n dimensions. I want a less squeaky board, sorry. So why is this true? Well, it's easy to show this is true, actually. So suppose that U is an element of SUN. Okay, well, that means it's a unitary matrix with determinant 1. Okay, so the unitary condition is just saying that U times U dagger is equal to 1. So let's write that out with indices. That says that uij times u bar jk is equal to delta ik. And then determinant of u is equal to 1. Well, if we write that out in terms of with indices, that says that epsilon I1 through in, the you know, just if you just write down the expression for the determinant of U, it's the totally antisymmetric tensor with n components, I1 through In, contracted with U I1 1, U I2 2, up to U In n, and that's supposed to be equal to 1. Okay, but now if you imagine just flipping any of these factors with one another, because they're all contracted with the epsilon tensor, you'll pick up minus signs, and so you can easily convince yourself that if I replace these with arbitrary indices, J1, J2, and Jn, then that's the same as replacing the right-hand side here with the totally antisymmetric tensor with indices J1 through Jn. Okay, but then now if you think about it, I'll leave this as a little exercise to check, but it's very easy to check. Suppose you now multiply by the dagger, you multiply by U bar with indices Jn, Jn and Kn. So you contract, add a U bar whose index is contracted with this guy, and you do the same thing over here. So it ends up killing one factor of U over here and replacing it by a factor of U bar on this side. So for example, we would get this is equivalent, this together with this is equivalent to the identity that if I just have J1 I1 up to Jn minus 1, In minus 1, I leave off the nth factor here. That's equal to epsilon tensor with indices J1 through Jn contracted with one factor of U bar. Jn with indices Jn and I. Okay, and then I won't write it down, but you know, you can bring as many factors, you can take as many factors of U across the equal sign to the other side and convert them into U bars. Do that as many times as you like. Okay, but because of that, you can but then imagine, let's consider an element of lambda 2 of C5. Okay, so imagine a two form in five dimensions. Okay, so it's, if we write it in tensor notation, if we write its indices explicitly, it's a guy that carries two indices and it's anti-symmetric. It's an anti-symmetric tensor with two indices. Okay, and under SU5, how does it transform? Well, it transforms like a tensor. So it transforms to, I'll call these two indices, let me call them I1 and J1. Sorry, let me call them I1 and I2. Let's say its two indices are I1 and I2. Then under an SU5 transformation, it transforms like a tensor. I1, J1, I2, J2, by J1, J2. Okay, but so now suppose that I defined this dual object, psi bar, with three lowered indices, J1, J2, J3, by applying the epsilon tensor to this, epsilon, J1, J2, J3, J4, J5 times phi of J4, J5. And then I ask, okay, how does this guy transform? Well, I already know how this guy transforms. So I have my epsilon tensor just as before, but now this guy transforms according to this rule. So it becomes J4, I4, J5, I5 times phi, I4, I5. But then, using that rule that we derived for moving U's around when they're contracted with epsilons, I can rewrite this expression as epsilon of I1 through I5 contracted with, instead of contracting the fourth and fifth indices with U's, I can contract the first, second, and third indices with U bars. Okay, that's what that identity up top lets me do. Okay, but then this combined with this just is exactly how this guy was defined. So I can rewrite this expression now as my U bars, U bar I1, J1, U bar I2, J2, U bar I3, J3 times psi bar of I1, I2, I3. Okay, so what have we shown here? Well, we've shown two things. One is that psi with three lower indices here transforms exactly like the star of an element of lambda 3. Okay. So an element of lambda 3 would transform with three U's. So this guy instead is transforming with three U bars. So it's transforming as the star of this guy. On the other hand, it's related to an element of lambda 2 of C5 by just a change of basis. Because if you think about it, this is just a change of basis matrix. It connects each basis element. It's a one-to-one mapping between each basis element of this vector space and this vector space. So if you think about it, and this is something that unfortunately this will be part of a tutorial that unfortunately only comes after the break when Gong gets back. But if you think about it, this manipulation shows this, and more generally, the exactly parallel manipulation shows the fact that I mentioned at the top there, that P form in n dimensions transforms exactly like the star of an n minus p form. Okay, so now we're ready to show the final. Now we're ready to show this in the final 10 minutes. What's this? Want to maybe so will anyone be upset if I erase this board? I'm gonna go kill this one. Okay, good. So let's see piece by piece how this, let's look at lambda of C5. Okay, so lambda of C5, as we said, it has six components. There's the zero forms, the one forms, two forms, three forms, four forms, and the five forms. Okay, and each of these has dimension 5 choose 0, 5 choose 1, etc. So the dimensions here, this is a one-dimensional representation of SU5. This is a five-dimensional representation. This is 10-dimensional. And then these guys all invert the pattern. So this is 10-dimensional, 5-dimensional, and 1-dimensional. And so the total dimension here, if you add those up, is 32, which again is 2 to the 5. Okay, so that's how, if we just looked at the transformation of this 32-dimensional vector space under SU5, it would break up into irreducible representations like this. A one-dimensional representation, a 5, 10, a 10, a 5, and a 1. But now we want to see how it breaks up further when instead of transforming this under the full group SU5, we only transform it under this embedding, the unique embedding of the subgroup of SU3 times SU2 times U1. So let's just look component by component and see how they break up. So let's start with lambda to the zero forms, and five dimensions. Well, this is a one-dimensional representation. So in other words, this is the trivial representation of SU5. One-dimensional representation is the representation where every element just gets mapped to the identity element. Nothing happens already in SU5, so under a subgroup, it also isn't going to transform. So this is a one-dimensional representation, but let's write this trivial one-dimensional representation in this kind of notation, okay, in our tensor. Yeah.
Sorry, I missed the reason why we're looking at exterior algebras for representations. Sorry.
So The thing which I want to show, the result in SU5 is that if you look, is that the standard model gauge group, the standard model fermions happen to be nicely repackaged. There is this natural object, so SU5 is one of the smallest groups that can fit, is one of the smallest single component groups that can fit SU3 times SU2 times U1 as a subgroup. So we, in some sense, we've found the simplest embedding of the standard model gauge group into a bigger, as a subgroup of a bigger unified group. And then the thing which I'm trying to show is that there is a sense then in which there is also a nice unification, or at least partial unification of the, there's a nicer reinterpretation. More sense is made of the weird representation of the standard model fermions by saying, oh, there's this very natural geometric object associated with SU5, which is the algebra of, the exterior algebra of differential forms in five dimensions. And if you look at how they transform under this standard model subgroup, it'll break up into exactly the sum of all of these different bits. Okay, so it's not that there was any necessarily reason to look at this a priori, but once we got to SU5, it's one of the natural objects associated with SU5, and it happens to then act just like the standard model gauge group. Now, what exactly is the interpretation of that? Why is that happening? That's a different story. Really, nobody really has given a good reason for why that happens. So I'll discuss. You can write down a gauge theory that makes use of that fact, but somehow a fundamental explanation for why it happens isn't known. Okay, so this guy transforms trivially. If we write it in our tensor product notation, well, it transforms trivially under SU3, so we get C to the 1 for SU3. Transforms trivially under SU2, so we get another copy of C for SU2. And it transforms trivially under U1, so we would write this last factor as C0. And if we look over here, that vector space does appear here. Well, it actually appears both here and here. So we could identify that vector space with either new right or new right star. It turns out for later purposes, we're going to want to identify it with new right star. So let me do that already. But a priori right now, we wouldn't know which one to do. OK, what about lambda 1 of C5? Well, lambda 1 of C5, this is the basis of this vector space is all anti-symmetric combinations of a single basis vector. Well, of course, the anti-symmetry operation is trivial when implemented on a single product of a single vector. So this is just C5. Okay. This is nothing but the five-dimensional vector on which this matrix acts, and the question is, how does this five-component vector break up under this action? Well, you can see what happens. It breaks into the direct sum of two pieces. There's the top two-dimensional piece on which this block acts, and the bottom three-dimensional piece on which this block acts. So let's write the top two-dimensional piece in our notation. So the top two-dimensional piece, well, it's not acted on. It's acted on trivially by SU3 because the SU3 matrix is down here. It's acting on this thing. So it acts trivially under SU3, but it transforms as a doublet under SU2 because it is hit by this 2x2 unitary. And then it transforms with charge 3 under U1. Okay? So this guy transforms as C tensor C2 tensor C sub 3. Okay, that's the top That's the top component. And then direct sum with the bottom component. What, how does that transform? Well, now it does transform as a triplet under SU3. It transforms trivially under SU2 because the SU2 matrix is up here, acting only up here. And its U1 charge is minus two. Okay, so this guy looks like C3. Answer C, because it transforms trivially under SU2. Answer C sub minus two. Okay, so we look at our list here. So far we've checked off this guy. We look at our list here, C tensor C2, tensor C3. Okay, well, that almost looks like this guy, except here we have a C2 star and there we have a C2. But actually recall from earlier in the course that the two-dimensional representation of C2 is equivalent to the star of the two-dimensional representation of C2. In fact, we now have a derivation of that fact. It's an example of that, that result up there. If you take P equals 1 and N equals 2, you exactly derive this fact that the 2 and the 2 star of SU2 are isomorphic to one another. Okay, so actually, for that reason, this, because C2 is the same as C2 star, this is the same, is exactly the same as this, okay? So first component here is L left star. And the second component, C3 tensor C tensor C sub minus two is exactly this guy, D right. Yeah. I'm going to run out of, that's clearly as high as I can go. I'll have to move that board down eventually. Okay. Now the last case we have to do is lambda 2, because then after that everything will, all the other cases will follow by that rule. We won't have to do any more calculations. So let's just do this last guy. And I just started a couple minutes late. I'm just going to take a couple more minutes. I'm really almost there, and I just want to get the punchline here. So let me use the notation that this that C5 breaks into this subspace, which I'll call V, and this subspace, which I'll call W. Okay, so then here, this is really lambda 2 of V plus W. But whenever you have lambda 2 of the direct sum of two vector spaces, it's a simple exercise to convince yourself that just from the definition of what lambda 2 is, and from the definition of what V plus W is, that's lambda 2, that's equal to lambda 2 of V, the two forms in V, plus the two forms in W, and then plus the vector space V tensor W. So it has these three components. And so what do we get here? So what if we take lambda 2 of this vector space, lambda 2 of V? Well, that's easy to compute. The SU3 part is trivial. So when we take tensor product of trivial with trivial, it'll still be trivial. So there'll be nothing going on in the SU3 part. But then here we have C2, and we want to take, this is where the action is. We want to take, we have this two-dimensional vector space. We want to take the two forms in it. Well, the two forms in two dimensions, they form a one-dimensional vector space. Because, you know, remember, as we go up in n dimensions, the highest forms you can have in n dimensions are n forms. And there's only one of them, because the number is n choose n, which is one. Okay, so when we take the outer product of this guy with itself, when we take the two forms, there's only one two form in two dimensions. And so since it's a one-dimensional representation, it means we get the trivial representation of SU2. And then, since we're looking at the two forms here, each individual basis vector here transformed with a charge 3, so when we take a product, we get charge 6 under U1. Okay, so that's the first component there. That's this guy. Now let's similarly work out this guy. Well, now the SU2 component is trivial, so it's going to remain trivial under tensoring. The U1 component, well, we had each basis vector transformed with charge minus 2, and so U1 charge minus 2. So now when we take pairs of them to form two forms, we're going to get charge minus 4. Okay, so the final two pieces, the SU2 part will be trivial, and the U1 part will be minus 4. We'll have charge minus 4. And now what about the two forms in three dimensions? So here, in other words, all the action is when we take the antisymmetric bit of the two forms in C3. Well, we showed that the two forms in C3 transform like the star of the one forms in C3. Well, the one forms in C3, that's just a vector in C3. So that transforms like a triplet. So we want the star. So the two forms in C3 transform like the star of that. So in other words, we get a factor of C3 star here. And then finally, the final component here, we're just supposed to take the tensor product of a space transforming like this and a space transforming like that. Well, when we take the tensor product of a space that transforms trivially under SU3 and a triplet under SU3, we just get something that transforms like a triplet under SU3, if you think about how the tensor product works. And similarly, when we take a factor that transforms like a doublet under SU2 times a factor that transforms trivially, we get a doublet under SU2. And then finally, every basis element here transforms like charge 3. Every basis element here transforms like charge minus 2. So whenever we take the product of two basis vectors, it'll transform with charge 1. U1 charge 1. And so if we look through here, we get exactly, this guy is exactly E right star. If you look up there. This guy is exactly the anti up quark U right star. And this guy is exactly Q left, according to that table. So we've now managed to get from lambda 0, lambda 1, and lambda 2, we've managed to get, if you count it up, we've managed to get exactly half of the 12 representations written here. And then from the rest, well, we don't have to do any more calculation because lambda 3 of C5 is just the star of whatever we got for lambda 2 of C5 by that rule in the upper left corner. And similarly, lambda 4 of C5 is just the star of lambda 1 of C5. And lambda 0 and lambda 5 of C5 is the star of lambda 0 of C5. Okay, so we've computed all of the representations, and what you find is that if you just put it all together, and this will, sorry, this is, I'm just, I'm trying to summarize the end I recommend doing this soon while it's still fresh in your brain, but there will also be part of a tutorial that will be just checking that you, partly about checking that one knows what's going on here. But so the bottom line is, at the end of the day, you get that if you look at the full exterior algebra, well, it breaks into two parts. If you look at the sum of all the even forms, the 0, 2, and 4-dimensional forms, the lambda even, the even-dimensional forms in C5, plus the odd-dimensional forms in C5, the 1 forms, 3 forms, and 5 forms, well, you'll find that this is exactly the direct sum of representations that we called F over there, and this is exactly the direct sum that we called F star. So, that's the punchline I wanted to get to. Yes.
Congrats.
Did you say congrats? Yes, yes, I agree. I agree. Congrats, congrats to us. It's a great mystery.
I still have a question. We just showed that we had this thing that, oh, if we want to invent it, we need to take the mod 6.
Yes.
So that means that having charge 6 and having charge 0 is the same, or sort of, right? I get it.
Let's see. Is that quite what it says? No. I wouldn't go that far. No, sorry. I wouldn't say that exactly. You know, in other words, remember, it's only when you take a particular, it's only when you choose alpha. In general, the theory has gauge symmetry under U1, where alpha can be an arbitrary element, an arbitrary complex space. It's only when we take it to be a sixth root of unity that we get this projection that we get this triviality projection. So I don't think it's true that for general alpha that the transformation is the same when you change the charge by 6. So for example, if you took a guy like the right-handed neutrino who currently has no charge, it's completely not charged under anything, and you changed its charge to 6, then you wouldn't get the same terms in the standard model. You would have certain terms that would be ruled out that previously were allowed.
Okay, so what's the price we have to pay to having this mod 6? It feels...
Well, you know, it's related to the fact that everybody is a fraction of 6, is a multiple of 1/6 here, but in detail, it's not just that you could choose any combination of fractions of 1/6 here. It has to be this thing. Unfortunately, it's the board that I erased, but it was this thing where not only do the charges have to be a fraction of 1/6, not only do they all have to be some multiple of 1/6, but those fractions have to be chosen in combination with the other SU2 and SU3 charges, so that whenever I take this particular element and act on the field, none of them transform. So it's so that's the price you have to pay. Apparently, if SU5 grand unification or something like it is on the right track, the charges had to be arranged in this way, and you're not allowed to add a new fermion to the theory that violates this property. You can add new fermions with different charges, but always you have to be adding the SU3 and SU2, appropriate SU3 and SU2 charges, so that the combined effect will be trivial whenever you take this special sort of one of these 6 special elements and apply it. All right.